Hello everyone, welcome again to another episode of BitNote. We'll be playing some great video game music, so I hope you enjoy. Alright, let's start off. I actually played a track by the same composer last week. This is a bit of a different one, so have a listen and I hope you enjoy. So, how many of you know what game that's from? That is from the classic Comic Zone, released by Sega in the mid-90s for the Sega Dreamcast. The music there was by Howard Drossin. He worked a lot in Sega and created a lot of themes for them during the Mega Drive era, but he's also done a lot of musical composition in other areas, such as indie films. The track I recently played in a previous episode, Toxic Caves, was also composed by him. So he's got some good talent, and what you just heard was from Comic Zone. So Comic Zone, of course, created by Sega. So what's Comic Zone about? Well, to be honest, when it was first released, Comic Zone never really quite got the attention it deserved. It was kind of released, it was kind of like that new break sort of game with a new idea that broke just when the Mega Drive was going downhill, so no one was really putting that much focus into the new games that were being released from the Mega Drive. But it was released in 1995, but at the same time, it was a good idea and it was taking a really nice direction. The idea is that you are a comic book creator. You're sitting down, writing down your comic, when a bolt of lightning strikes your comic and one of your villains comes to life and suddenly forces you into the comic book world because he can't kill you in the real world, and so he forces you to fight in the comic book world where he feels he can kill you. So, essentially, what you're doing is you're playing the game, and it's kind of like a side-scrolling when you control them and you can with fighting and everything. But what happens is you start up at the top left panel of a comic page, and as you defeat the enemies there, you move on to the next panel and the next panel. And so you're making your way all the way down through the various different panels in the comic book until you eventually get to the bottom right panel, in which case you move on to the next page. So it was actually a really nice visual aesthetic to the whole thing. The idea that, you know, you're a comic creator just battling his way through a comic, dealing with like some sort of future New York City and all these larger than life villain and stylistically themed villains. So it was... The premise of being in a comic just gave them great potential to come up with all these crazy ideas. And it was also great. The combat was good. I mean, there was a nice system where you could, you know, about involving, you know, kicking and stuff. And it just flowed really well. Actually, I was actually just playing the game just a few nights ago on a Mega Collection for the Xbox 360. You know, there was this like one game that contained like 20 or 30 classic Sega Mega Drive games. And I mean, it still holds up. It's just there's a lot of fast reflexes. There's a lot of beating them up. But there's also a nice little bit of strategy, and that's what I really like about it. You see, back when genres are... These days, of course, if you're making a shooting game, you know, it's almost like you shouldn't put any cerebral or intelligent parts into it, because there's always going to be a portion of your audience that's going to freak and say, wait a sec, I don't know how to get past this. What am I going to do here? But back then, I mean, they weren't afraid to throw in a couple of little smart elements in there, or very small, nothing that you wouldn't force you to get by, but bits that would just generally, you know, force you to think things out a little before proceeding. And this game was one of those things. For instance, often you'd deal with obstacles, and if you barge them down or attack them, they'd gradually diminish your health. So the smart thing would be to do was to gain dynamite and blow the thing up. But of course, the dynamite mightn't be available in that exact panel that you're in. You may have had to gain it for a previous panel. And so you're able to pick up a couple of items. And so the idea is, as you play through the game, you're learning more about the environment and realizing, okay, I pick up this set of items, and I use this item here, and I use this item here. And I mean, you know, your entire focus is to keep your health as far as full as possible and get to the end of the page. So you're being strategic about thinking, what can you use and at what points? It gets, normally speaking, I mean, there's another more simple example. You open up a trap door and you've got the sense that there's something dangerous below, but you're not sure. Now, there happens to be a crate of explosives in the same room as you are. So if you're smart, you'll push the crate into the hole and it will deal with whatever's there. But of course, if you don't do that, you can still fall down the hole, you can still get damaged, but you'll keep going on. And that was one of the great ideas about the more cerebral elements of this game. And I mean, like, cerebral in comparison to the basic fighting action. I mean, I'm not saying this is missed here. It's not like going to completely throw you for a loop. But it was smart enough so that, you know, it was still a challenge. It was still a little thing that you ticked over. But if you didn't care about that sort of stuff at all, if you were just going to go in for the brutal fight, then you'd just end up losing a bit of health. I mean, you know, you wouldn't really get stuck. You just tend to lose a lot of health. Although there were one or two parts you get stuck, but, you know, you'd have to just figure it out. The aesthetics, like I said, were nice. Bright colours, you know, you're playing at the comic book creator, who's like this guy with a yellow ponytail and interesting fashion sense, and he's got his own pet rat and whatever. And the pet rat can actually launch electrical attacks, which is kind of a funny thing. And it's one of those games that's just memorable, that you can just pick up and play, have a lot of fun with, and just really just has character that you enjoy. No sequel was ever created. There was plans for a 3D version at the time that never came true, although if you did put it into 3D, it'd be harder to get the whole little panel aesthetics. It's kind of hard to describe, but it was a nice little theme over to it. It's kind of a pity that the game hasn't actually, you know, been revived or gotten more attention at the time it was released. But in its own way, it's actually gotten more publicity after it's been released. You see, Sega have actually released quite a few Mega Drive collections. They've released one for the PSP, they've released one for the Xbox 360, both of which I've played. And also, they've also tended to release a couple of Sonic the Hedgehog classic games collections for various platforms. And those games collections tend to contain a couple of other Sega games, including Comic Zone. So it's really nice that the game's still getting more publicity and exposure, and that still someone can go out today and possibly have a chance of buying a game in a game shop that'll contain Comic Zone on it. And trust me, it's a good game. Very enjoyable. Okay, let's see now. I'm going to move on to a bit of a classic theme. I had a bit of an aversion to playing this, and that's not because it's a good tune. It is a bit tuned, but actually, forget my criticism. I shouldn't let my prejudices get in the way of the audio enjoyment of my listening public. So I'll just say, sit back, enjoy it. This is a good song. This is one of the big songs, let me tell you. This is when people talk about the best. Look, just have a listen and you make up your own mind. It's a good one. Well, I think a lot of people out there would recognize this one, at least a lot of the gamers out there. That, of course, was Halo by Martin O'Donnell from the Halo Combat Evolved by Bungie. Now, as many of you know, Halo is a classic game, definitely one of the most influential games in video game history. Every so often, you get a game in video game history that just changes things, that suddenly everything after it is trying to be like it. Almost whatever people have thought about it. Halo was like that sort of game for the first-person shooter genre, especially the first-person console genre. When Microsoft originally launched their Xbox, Halo was the game that they promoted. They said they wanted it to be the game that defined their system, and in a lot of ways it did. So, what was so successful about Halo? Well, in a lot of ways it actually did a lot of things that other games had done. I mean, it had animated cutscenes, it was your Master Chief, cyborg guy who never showed his face, who was constantly fighting these alien evils. I mean, it's all pretty generic. The one really innovative part about it, or people saw, was the idea is that instead of fighting aliens on a planet, you're basically fighting them on this great big ring, the inside of the ring that was flying through space, or orbiting something, probably, and that was the titular Halo. But then again, a bunch of people set up, oh, no, you just stole that from Larry Niven's Ringworld series. Because, you know, if you're going to steal something, you might as well steal it from obscure science fiction books. I mean, obviously, people who read science fiction books are never going to call you out on something else like that. But that's kind of irrelevant. And I'll tell you why it's irrelevant. I remember playing Halo. I remember, you know, the first few levels are actually really silly. You're just fighting around in this spaceship and everything's grey and you're meant to obviously take advantage of the aliens and their shutters go blah, 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 blah. Anyway, you finally crash land on the actual Halo itself, and then you're flying around. Maybe you don't look up more or less because you're just trying to deal with it or survive. And then suddenly you see it. You look towards the horizon, and there upon it you can see the landscape. You see the landscape. It moves down. It moves forward, and then suddenly the entire landscape moves up. I mean, it just suddenly curves upwards into a great big, and suddenly gets narrower and narrower until a great big thin streak that, to a very thin line that suddenly stretches all the way straight up, all the way around you, over your head. You turn around and look, you see that line go all the way back down and then get wider and spread right back into the landscape. And then you see you're on it. I mean, you know, you're just so used to normally being on a planet and the horizon's just receding away from you. Suddenly to see this whole ring world, to be basically on the inside of this ring, to realize, hey, this is all just one tiny, like, circular strip that I'm just on. And it's just a great feeling, actually. It completely gives you the sense of being somewhere else, at least the first time you see it. And It's just such a surprise, and I love that sort of environment stuff about it. Other parts of Halo, of course, were the graphics. I mean, I remember I was playing it for the first time in some game shop, and the guy said, "Look down, look down, look down." So I looked down, and I just saw some beautiful grass. I mean, I know grass, you know, you wouldn't think it, but it seemed almost like it was like bursting from the ground. It was probably, I mean, graphics have kind of moved on, blah, 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 but it kind of really felt it. And when I looked at that grass and everything, it just felt that this was a studio that was trying to make this world come alive for me. And there were other parts too, the actual gameplay. As you know, up to then, there were plenty of games there that involved you walking around and shooting stuff. Battlezone was the first game where you could look where you wanted to shoot and press a button and a bullet would go in that direction. Then there was Wolfenstein 3D, which demonstrated, okay, you could do this in a corridor shooter. Then, of course, Doom. That was the classic one that really popularized the first-person shooter genre. And there are a couple of others. GoldenEye 64 showed it could be done for consoles. And Half-Life, I think, one of my favorites, but I'm going to have to shelve the Half-Life discussion. That one showed how you put narratives in, which actually I always thought that Halo was a little step backwards when it came to how to do narratives in video games. But let's cut that out for now. But what Halo did was they showed how you could really do it from a console. Normally, how you can make a first-person shooter for a console. Normally, you had a wider range of weapons and you'd switch between them all. And it would be, and you know, you wouldn't really think that much of it because that was the way you did it too. If you wanted to shoot the bazooka, you'd swap through all the weapons until you got to the bazooka. It used to be a lot easier. You see, a lot of these first-person shooters were on the keyboard where you could just press the key 1 or press the key 2 or just flip the mouse scroll wheel and quickly get your weapon. But obviously in Halo, it was a lot different. You know, you just had the Xbox controller, which had some triggers. It wasn't very easy to switch between them. Although some consoles have tried to... Although some games you're actually able to use an analog stick or a D-pad to select the exact weapon. But what Halo did was very interesting. For a start, they said, you want to throw a grenade? Okay, but the grenade is a completely separate button. Okay, and if you want to do a melee attack, you know, which is, you know, a brunt force attack, you know, that doesn't use ammunition, you just hit whatever's right in front of you, that's also a separate weapon. And also, they say you can only carry a separate button. And also, you can only carry two weapons. So what all this did was actually pretty simple. If you were suddenly in an attack and you were shooting an enemy and he suddenly came right up to you, what you could, you know, instead of, what you could then do is quickly press the melee button and you'd suddenly belt the enemy. And this was so much different. I mean, a lot of this stuff was like, why didn't we think of this beforehand? Because up to then, you know, if you were like shooting machine gunning an enemy who was right up to you, if you wanted to hit him, you'd have to quickly switch over to the melee weapon and then attack. So the idea of just making it a simple button you press just gave instantaneous feedback. The same thing went for grenades. I mean, Bungie Studios understood that, you know, grenades are not like normal weapons. You don't use them in the same circumstances as normal weapons. So by mapping the grenades to a separate button, you could be shooting and then throwing grenade at the same time. So you'd be able to use grenades a lot more strategically. So there was that one, so those grenades. And as for the weapons, well, like I said, in old games, you used to have so many different weapons. But with this, you only had two. But you had one button that would swap between the two weapons. So if you weren't holding the correct weapon, all you had to do was press a button and you'd be holding the other weapon. And, of course, this meant you'd had to be a little careful. You'd walk through this terrain and you'd see a new weapon on the ground. You'd say, okay, I've got two weapons. Which one should I swap for this one? Or maybe I don't like the weapon on the ground and it'll go on. It basically encouraged you to be prepared for the situation, to make decisions in advance of which weapon to use. And then when the tense of combat, you just made quick snap decisions of which weapon to use. It was very smart. And, of course, the recharging health. I mean, as you can see here, there's a theme here. Bungie were like looking at all the problems of console first-person shooters and saying, okay, how do we solve this? How do we make it more fluid? And this is something that every game developer should do. They should question existing logic, because there were countless games, numerous games released for consoles, where it would just be an array of weapons and the user would just have to quickly switch through each one. And it'd be in minor frustration and whatever, but it wasn't exactly glaring. But Bungie, like I said, they rethought it. They thought, how can we do to fix it? And then, of course, the above solutions are how they did it. And they also fixed another thing. Another problem I had also with a lot of games before Halo was that, like, if you were in a tough firefight and suddenly had 1% of health left, then if you were into even a mildly tricky firefight the next time, you could get instantly killed because you only had 1 point of health and there's almost no way you could do it. It could get very frustrating. With Bungie, they figured you'd have rechargeable health. If you were in the middle of a firefight and you suffered too much damage, of course you'd die. But if you succeeded and waited a while, your health would recharge, and then that way you'd be ready for the next firefight. So, with so many great ideas, with a vibrant world, and with all these great rethinking of how to do the of combat and how to do a console. I mean, what was the problem? For a start, a lot of games ripped it off in terrible ways and just thought that if they copied Halo, they could have the formula of success. Well, my friends, the formula of success was that the developers were rethinking the game, rethinking what went before it and trying to improve it. So when people were just outright copying them, they really didn't appreciate a lot of the decisions. For instance, that rechargeable health thing, what would happen then is instead of people just doing the best they could in a firefight, they'd go halfway through a firefight, realize they were low in health, and so run away from the firefight, hide somewhere, wait for the health to recharge, and return back. It caused the gameplay to be very fragmented. The weapon thing wasn't so bad, but it has to be balanced with the rest of the game, and a few years recently, Duke Nukem Forever was released, and they had so many great innovative weapons, but they forced themselves to directly copy Halo, and as a result, even though there were some neat weapons in them, you couldn't really feel that you could use any of them whenever you wanted to. I think what scared people about Halo was that in some ways, people were holding it up as like the ultimate video game, as like the game that other games should be like. And that's always a scary thing, because I think that video games should always be about, you know, exploring new avenues, exploring new things. If you ever have a game that you say, this is the be-all and end-all of video games, then you're effectively limiting yourself. You're effectively saying, this is the point you should aim for. Go no further. That's it. Hurrah, hurrah. Goodbye. And obviously, I completely don't agree with that. But a lot of people seem to act as if that was the case. And obviously, if people are limiting their own works and or not thinking things through and just ripping off something, you know, it's just so frustrating when you play a game or take something up. I mean, I would much rather a game came up with a whole load of terrible mistakes that were completely the game's own mistakes rather than mistakes that were copied from another game. Because at least if you're playing at their own mistakes, you're playing new mistakes, you're finding new ways that the game screws up. If something just rips something off and just doesn't really innovate or anything on it, then it's like an empty shell. And I think video games, it owes video games should be a lot more than empty shells these days. Okay, that's my rant. On to the next game. Okay, so what I've just done is talk about a multi-million selling blockbuster video game that broke financial revenue figures everywhere. Let's move on to an obscure, somewhat obscure indie game called Amnesia: The Dark Descent. Now, boy, I actually played the games made by the Penumbra games, which were made by this game's development beforehand. And when Amnesia came out, I was kind of excited. Amnesia is basically a horror game. You're a guy called Daniel. You wake up. You have amnesia. And you find yourself in a castle with a note from yourself, literally telling you that there is a person that needs to die. So, to be honest, I never really found that as quite a good motivation. It was saying there is a baron who you must kill, and I never found out, okay, why am I doing this? But apparently you trust yourself, and you begin on this quest. And unfortunately, the castle is downright haunted. And it gets scary. There are monsters and mutants, and it just kind of gets a little more scary. But the great thing about Amnesia is that you can't actually attack or really, it's hard to defend yourself against any of these creatures. You basically don't have a weapon except a lamp, which you can't swing. You really don't have anything to rely on. So it's all just about survival. And that's where Amnesia gets to you. That's like the darkened corridors, the need to light a lamp to regain your sanity, but the fear that a monster will be looking and take attention of you if he does. The gradual procession through the castle, through various parts of it, as suddenly you start to realize a lot of supernatural stuff happening. How some of these red stuff starts appearing on walls. How suddenly you start finding notes of some. You find notes written of terrible things that have happened, and you're starting to piece together exactly what led you to this castle in some Eastern European state and exactly what you're doing there and some of the things you may have done. And it starts to get more creepy. You find out that torture is being done in this castle, but you realize that you mightn't have actually done anything to prevent it, and you start to realize that your soul isn't exactly pure either. And that's kind of scary. I mean, I remember playing the game and thinking, boy, all these creatures are out to get me. And then suddenly I read some of my own notes or letters in the game and suddenly started to realize, wait a second, is it because of something I've done or the character has done that because of the actions of this character, these ghosts aren't just attacking completely but because of a sense of revenge to get back at me? And that's a scary thing. I mean, it's like the character earned the torment he's getting. I mean, what's more scary, something that happens to you out of the blue or something that happens entirely to you because of the consequence of your own actions? How often are we haunted by the consequences of our own actions? And I think that obviously they put it into very brutal terms because the character Daniel did some terrible stuff that will most likely violate the Geneva Convention. But, I mean, that's it. This is just the way that you go down. The game is called Amnesia: The Dark Descent, and obviously that descent refers to a little more than the fact that you just have to get to the lower levels of the castle in order to find the Baron. Obviously, great atmosphere. It was developed by Frictional Games, and the music you're about to hear is the ending theme, Daniel's ending. Daniel's the main character, composed by Mikko Tarmia, who's actually a Finnish composer, and I've had a couple of music by Finnish composers, such as from Max Payne and Shadowgrounds here. So nice to have another Finnish composer. And so with this song, I'll leave it at that. So, hopes this has been David Collins with a Bitnote. I'll leave you with the ending theme of Amnesia: The Dark Descent. I hope you've enjoyed it, and all the best. Sweet dreams.